This is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. TV sitcoms have the power to entertain, comfort, and practically hypnotize. Ask anyone who's emerged blinking in the sunlight after binging an entire season of Schitt's Creek, wondering what day it is. But it's not all just about delivering laughs. The sitcom has also been a driver of societal change, a kind of Trojan horse for empathy for those who are different from you, and understanding of changing cultural norms. That may be especially true when it comes to helping advance LGBTQ+ rights. Seattle writer and YouTuber Matt Baume takes a closer look at this history in his new book, Hi Honey, I'm Homo, Sitcoms, Specials, and the Queering of American Culture. In it, he charts the course of decades of television, from Bewitched to The Golden Girls and Modern Family, how it embraced queer culture and how it helped change America. Matt Baume, welcome to Soundside, and thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how much television did you watch in the course of writing this book?
Hours and hours and hours. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this book is I just wanted to watch a lot of TV, and it paid off. So, hooray. But I've been watching going all the way back to the early days, the start of television, and finding, the early broadcasts in the 40s and looking for queer stuff in there with Milton Berle getting in drag. This is as close as you could get, maybe. Then up to Bewitched in the 60s and All in the Family, of course, and to The Golden Girls and Friends and Will and Grace and Modern Family. Just watching as much of this as I can just surrounding myself with hours and hours of TV.
Wow. So the book starts in the 60s with Bewitched, but you were saying that you actually did go back before that. What was the queer representation, if we can even call it that, before the 60s?
Well, the short answer to that question is bad.
Yeah.
It was not good. So there was a broadcast code for the early days of television that basically prevented what was referred to then as sex perversion and, covered anything that could be remotely considered queer. Occasionally, maybe you'd catch a comedian dressing in drag. You might catch a very risque joke, like a very oblique reference to like Christine Jorgensen and, a sex change operation or something like that. But, you would really have to search to find anything that might be considered queer, even up until the late 60s into the 70s. Kind of the name of the game was coding it and making it kind of hidden and plausibly deniable. So you can find, for example, there's an episode of TV, I think it might be on Dan August, where Richard Dreyfuss plays a maybe gay youth.
Hmm.
He's maybe like 20 or so, and he might be gay or he might just be a hippie. Hard to say.
Yeah. And viewers can make of that what they will.
Exactly. Exactly.
You wrote about Bewitched, which is something I loved watching on Nick at Night as a kid. It's an old show. I mean, it started in 1964, and it's not something that most people would associate with queer representation. I mean, they're in a very traditional Darren and Samantha mm-hmm. marriage. She's, working at home, cleaning the house and things like that. She just does it with magic. Why was this an important point to mark in the history of LGBTQ+ representation on TV?
So Bewitched is a fascinating artifact because, you could just watch it, enjoy it, and there's funny jokes and wacky hijinks, and great, we're having a good time. But it also sits at this really interesting time because it started pre-Stonewall. There had been some, queer actions at bars and, riots against police entrapment and that kind of thing in the past. But Bewitched straddles essentially the birth of the modern queer liberation movement. And it starts in a place where it does feel very mid-century. It's a show about a secret witch who marries a mortal and they try to blend in with normal society. And, normal in air quotes there. But the show's very much about, keeping secrets. And, you could read it as a metaphor for a mixed religion marriage or a mixed race marriage. Or, it's a show that's pushing as far as a show could at that time at the bounds of what was considered very traditional family. And so, and Elizabeth Montgomery, who's the star and, had a lot of authority on that show, has said, after it went off the air, she did interviews where she talked about how they were aware that this show could be read as a metaphor for queer people's lives. Somebody hiding in plain sight, trying to blend in and adopting the mannerisms of the status quo, while also, maintaining her relationship with a secret society that most people don't know about. And Elizabeth has said that they were aware that this is one reading of the show and that they wanted the show to be appealing to people who felt like outsiders.
Darren, how could you? You of all people, you should know better. That's the kind of thing we're trying to fight.
What are you talking about?
That picture, it's offensive.
Offensive?
Is that how you think I look?
Will you calm down,
well,
Sam?
Well, do you?
Of course not.
Then why did you do it?
Because that's the way most people think witches look.
Is that any reason to discriminate against a minority group?
What minority group?
Witches, of course.
This is a show that comes just as, like, a civil rights movement is getting going and ends just as television is transforming into something that approaches reality a lot more closely with All in the Family and Barney Miller and more realistic shows than we'd seen in the past when it's, you know, the boss is coming to dinner and I burned the roast. What do I do? Well, now we're, you know, into the 70s, we're starting to talk about, like, venereal disease. You know, it's a very different thing. And Bewitched goes from one universe to another universe over the course of its run.
Yeah. And nobody is more camp and just lovely and wonderful in her proud outsiderness than Agnes Moorehead playing Samantha's mother. I just think back, because I've read your book now, I know that a lot of cast and people who worked on the show had their own struggles with living a private life that they couldn't share with the public. And Dick Sargent, the actor who played the second Darren, had this journey with coming out. You know, how did that compare to the struggles of, well, first of all, tell us about Dick Sargent's journey, and then tell me, how did that compare with the struggles of other closeted actors at the time?
Yeah, his experience is, I think, really illuminating. So here's an actor who was playing a heterosexual man on Bewitched, and, you know, this was kind of where he was in his career. These were the kind of roles that he would play. Of course, he's closeted the whole time, and it's only in the 90s that it really feels safe for him to come out because, you know, he's not alone as a closeted actor in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, you know, acknowledging the reality that if he was to come out, if it was to become public knowledge, you know, first of all, in the early part of his career in the 60s, in a lot of the country, it's a crime or it's considered a mental illness, professionally considered a mental illness by doctors until the early 1970s. So, you know, of course, he, like so many others, has to maintain a closet. You know, Jim Nabors and Rock Hudson and so many other, you know, closeted people who just had to play a game and, you know, place publicity in magazines where they talk about, oh, well, you know, he's just so devoted to his career. Or in Liberace's case, he just really loves his mother and hasn't found a girl who can compare.
Yeah. Or they would make up fake wives sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
there wouldn't just be the beard relationship where you have a wife that, you know, you have an agreement with. I mean, you talk about actors actually referencing people that were fictional.
Yeah.
In order to get by and to be safe in interviews.
Yeah. Well, part of the research I did for this book was digging into old magazines that really are quite hard to find. But, you know, God bless the people who saved TV guides from 50 years ago. So I found an interview with that actor where he talks about his wife or his past relationships with women. And those just did not exist. Raymond Burr did the same thing. He made up a wife and a kid who had died under mysterious circumstances, you know, all the while maintaining a relationship with, I think his partner was an art gallery owner.
Yeah. And they were together for decades.
Yeah, exactly.
And they couldn't talk about it.
Same thing with Jim Nabors. Yeah.
That's I mean, I know you know it intellectually, but then when you actually, you know, read this and really watch the lengths to which people, you know, had to go because of the fear of what would happen to their lives, it's really remarkable and impactful. Let's talk about Barney Miller, which was an ABC sitcom that I wasn't familiar with before reading the book and really watching your YouTube channel, which is an excellent resource as well. It debuted in 1975, and Barney Miller's about this police precinct in Greenwich Village. And season one includes a recurring character named Marty, who is a lovable, flamboyant scamp. He's openly gay, and he's constantly getting arrested and quipping his way out of tough spots, which is fun, but Marty also plays into a lot of stereotypes at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But then the showrunner of Barney Miller, whose name is Danny Arnold, he doesn't stop there. After season one, he takes on this challenge of improving the depiction of the Marty character.
Mm-hmm.
And he really goes to the mat to air an episode that's called Discovery. What is Discovery? Why was this an important episode of television?
Yeah. So, you know, I think Marty is a very fun character in his early incarnations, but he's also a criminal. And, you know, there's a bit of a sleaze to him. But then when he comes back, he's been rewritten slightly, like the character's not that different, but now he has a partner. He is not committing a crime. He's reporting that he's been the victim of a crime. And we see, you know, a much more rich inner life for this guy, for this gay man who has, you know, he's got a partner named Daryl, and he considers the police his friends. Now, there may be a little bit of propaganda going on here, trying to, you know, clean up the relationship that queer people would have had with police in Greenwich Village.
Who were constantly harassing them. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So the show is set in Greenwich Village at a police precinct. And in real life, things would probably have been a bit rockier. But look, this is a sitcom. Things are a little idealized. And I think what's lovely about this episode is we see the police helping a queer person. We see a queer person having an emotional experience where they've been a victim of a crime. They were shook down by somebody posing as a cop who is trying to extort money out of them. And so instead of just, you know, dealing with it, instead of just being like, I guess this is how it's got to be, they go to the police and the police catch the guy and problem solved. It's lovely to see the cops standing up for some queer people, which is, I think, one of the things that is so powerful about television. It helps us reflect on our lives. We can see stories that may feel familiar, but also how we'd like our lives to be. It you know, it gives us an opportunity to imagine a better world. And I think that's something that's happening in that episode of Barney Miller. And still, the gay guys get to be as funny as they can be, and yeah, they get all the best lines.
Yeah.
So I love that about the episode, too.
And a lot of it stands up today. I mean,
oh, yeah,
the twist ending with this beefcake Sergeant Forbes is amazing. I mean, it's like it absolutely holds up.
I just walked out and he grabbed me. I thought you were gay? A detective sergeant in the New York police force? Que sera, sera.
I want to talk about Soap, too, because I know that had a really personal resonance with you. It ran for 4 seasons starting in 1977. One of the things you talk about in the book and the YouTube channel is Billy Crystal's portrayal of a character named Jody Dallas. Why did Jody strike a chord with you?
You know, that was a character that I saw when Soap was in reruns. It was the 90s. I was living in a small town in Connecticut, and we had Comedy Central, and reruns of Soap were playing. And this show is just wild. It's kind of a parody of soap operas with every, like, alien abduction and a possessed baby and a priest who has sex and, you know. And
Is that a parody, or is that actually what happens? I mean, I saw Passions.
Yeah, no, it gets very close to what actual soap operas do. But it was very controversial at the time. People were like, oh, my God, I can't believe you're putting all this controversial stuff on television. And what really resonated for me when I was watching it in reruns was seeing Jody, the gay son of one of the, you know, of one half of the family. He plays a character who is confident and strong and who knows what he wants, and he's not hiding himself. He comes out to his brother in one early episode, and he comes out really confidently and bravely. And it provides a real moment of inspiration, I think, for queer people who are watching the show. And I'm watching it 20 years after it aired, and it felt incredibly timely to see somebody saying, no, I'm gay. You know, his brother's trying to deny it. He's like, no, it's not a joke. It's not something you can just say, probably not. I am gay. This is who I am. And if this changes how you feel about me, then you never really loved me at all. What an incredible message. And, you know, I spoke to some of the people who worked on that show, Marsha Posner-Williams, who worked on that, and the Golden Girls and a bunch of other stuff. And she described how they got letters from parents after that episode aired saying, thank you, this helps me understand my queer kid. I probably didn't use that word, but this helps me understand my kid in a way that I just never did before. And again, like the power of television. We might think of like a sitcom as, you know, silly, frivolous, it's kind of junk food television. But also, you know, when you do it right, like any medium, like any art form, you know, when it's done well, it can really change people's lives.
And you talk about this season 3 cliffhanger where Jody is trying to get custody of his infant daughter. And between the seasons, ABC's audience was actually polled to see who they thought the daughter should go with.
Yeah.
And the audience chose Jody 3-1.
Mm-hmm.
Did that surprise you?
It really did, because at the time, other surveys around the late 70s really didn't reflect well on public opinion about queer people. But now here you have, and I think this again shows the power of television, you've got a character with a personal story, someone people are really getting invested in, and they see the impact of discriminatory laws. You know, there's basically the storyline involves Jody fighting with his former partner, a woman. He has this, you know, this relationship with a woman. They have a baby. And does it go with a heterosexual family? Does it go with a gay man? And the audience, when they form a relationship with Jody, they're like, now I see, now I get it. And so much more effective than just, you know, hearing a slogan like, oh, love is love and, you know, equality for everyone. Those are nice ideas, but making it personal is what really changes everything.
Therefore, I have decided to break with normal tradition and award custody of the infant Wendy to her father, Jody Dallas.
Yeah.
hearing is adjourned.
You write about the activism that is happening in the real world that is helping to break down barriers during this time in the 70s and 80s for gay characters on television. But then, as you say with Jodi, the gay characters on television are also propelling people's understanding of gay people and their empathy with them, and therefore pushing forward the political agenda as well. Can you talk about that relationship between the two things, between fictional worlds and real life activism?
Yeah, there's an amazing virtuous cycle that's happening here. And obviously, usually, television creators don't set out to create social change. Even Norman Lear, who we think of as like an incredible activist, and he has done a million great things for the country. Norman Lear, when he's making television like All in the Family and Maude and The Jeffersons, Good Times, when he's making those shows, you know, he said in interviews many times, they're not thinking about how can they fix the country. They're thinking about how can we entertain people and how can we tell a funny, meaningful, emotional story about great characters.
Nobody wants to watch a lecture.
Exactly. Yeah, that's 100% true. And so they're just telling a great story. And what Norman Lear said to his writers was, read the newspaper, listen to what your families are talking about, write about what's happening in the world, reflect people's real lives. And so that's just what they did. And by doing that, there's this unintentional effect of people forming a closer relationship with characters who are not like them. All in the Family had Beverly LaSalle, a drag queen. It had a gay character early in season one named Steve. It had an amazing episode with Sammy Davis Jr. It tackles anti-Semitism. Like, this show touched on so many aspects of people's real lives. And, you know, seeing that reflected on television in this really unflinching way suddenly makes people reconsider their own bigotry and their own prejudice, which is, you know, not what they were setting out to do. And yet, you know, by telling the story of what's happening out in the world, suddenly these sitcoms and other TV shows like them are having an impact on the real world.
Yeah. That progress only goes so far, though, mm-hmm. right? I mean, let's jump up to the 90s. And we see somewhat of a backlash, although you do see these groundbreaking moments like Ellen coming out on her sitcom. You also see somewhat of a retrenchment where you have this sense that, for example, Friends is really featuring as a regular punchline in the show, just terrible homophobia. I mean, what was happening in the 90s on television where you, at the same time you were seeing these incredibly historic moments, you were also seeing just a terrible, really nasty backlash?
You know, that tension has always existed. It's always been there. And sometimes it's just a little more acute. I think of it as a tug of war. And sometimes people are just tugging a lot harder. And there was definitely, particularly around Ellen's coming out episode 97, a really strenuous tugging from both sides. One of the things that you're seeing there is in 92, a whole bunch of stuff happened. There was the presidential election, and in a way that it really hadn't before, queer issues became a focal point, not the only one, but military service, HIV, adoption, marriage, these were all big ticket items in the presidential election 92 in a way that they hadn't been before. There was also a march on Washington. There was a lot going on with lawsuits, legal stuff working its way. There's a Hawaii lawsuit that started to work its way through the court. And it really looked like we might get marriage equality early in the 90s. So there was a lot of stuff happening in real life that, you know, even if you didn't see queer people on fictional scripted television, you saw him on the news or you saw him in the newspaper. And so people were thinking about gay stuff more than they had before. And of course, television was eager to put that on. And sometimes they got it right and sometimes they got it wrong. I think Friends is a real mixed bag. Sometimes I think there are some good depictions on Friends. It's lovely. They had a lesbian marriage, and I think that's wonderful. But also sometimes "that's gay" was a frequent punchline on that show.
That's the joke.
Yeah, that's it.
There is nothing more than that.
Yep. Yeah. So I would say it's a little regressive. But, you know, also there's, you know, a gay man at the helm of that show. So, you know, I can't say that, like, they hated gay people. That's just the way television was at the time. "That's gay" was considered, an acceptable punchline. So, and, you know, that's one reason why you need more queer people behind the scenes and more diverse stories on screen. So eventually we can move past the easy jokes.
Matt, one consequential piece of television that is not included in the book is a reality TV show, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, which debuted in the early 2000s. And I remember it as being one of the first landmarks in my memory for gay representation on television, one that my family would actually gather around and watch as a group. I'm curious how you feel the reality show format compares in terms of impact to scripted shows that you cover in the book.
Yeah, I think reality is huge, especially those early shows. I'm thinking of like The Real World and Queer Eye in particular. So something that is really unique about reality shows is that kind of, most of the time, because of the way those shows work, everyone starts off on equal footing. When it's a, you know, competition or elimination show like Survivor, everybody has to start off of equal status. And so it's one of the rare times that you see queer characters and straight characters on equal footing, because that's just how these shows have to work. And I think it's really powerful to see that, we're creating a show where the gays and the straights are all coming out of the gate at exactly the same point. So I think that's really powerful. I think it really helps viewers think of queer people or people unlike them as equals. I think reality has done a huge amount of work in helping people to feel close to, you know, in kind of a parasocial way, they feel close to these characters that they see on television.
Yeah, parasocial relationships. I guess that reality television was doing that to us before we had social media, right?
Yeah.
As you point out in the book, television, specifically network comedies, it has this uncanny way of presenting issues that are important or sometimes even uncomfortable in this very palatable and relatable format for a wide swath of Americans. Now, that was more true when there was a few networks. You know, we had more of a monoculture and everyone would sit down and watch The Golden Girls or whatever else they were watching at that point. Do you think that we're losing that ability for television to impact the culture now that things are so fragmented? Do you think that, for example, a viewer who might be uncomfortable with a trans person in the abstract when they read the news is less likely today to watch a scripted show that would maybe make them understand and have empathy for a trans character versus back in the 70s and 80s when they might come across that in network television?
Yeah, I think fractured is exactly the right way to talk about it. And on one hand, it's a good thing that we have more diversity and more options, and you can go wherever, you know, to a million different streaming services and watch a thing that feels like it was made just for you. Great. But also, we do lose that water cooler culture that existed up until this, you know, rise of streaming, where, you know, the next day, 30 million people watched Seinfeld and we're all going to talk about it. And we all had a similar experience together. There's sort of a Rosetta Stone of television where we have sort of a common experience of having seen whatever the popular thing happened to be. And, you know, something that gets, you know, 2 million viewers today is considered a huge hit, whereas in the 80s, that would have been just a colossal flop. So, you know, everyone's so balkanized and in their own little bubbles. I do think we lose something by not having the one big thing that we're all talking about. I think maybe Game of Thrones was potentially one of the last times we're ever going to see something like that. Until, you know, maybe all the streaming stuff is going to consolidate. Who knows? But, you know, I think the solution there, and this is going to sound like, you know, oh, just make television differently. But I think the solution there is to get more queer stuff on TV. Whatever show it is, wherever it is, viewers have to demand that they be reflected on everything and in everything. Otherwise, yeah, it's going to be really easy for people who are conservative or bigoted or who just don't understand, who just don't recognize that, you know, queer people are a fact of life. I think it'll become increasingly tempting for those people just to not even know that we exist. And so that's why we just have to demand like, oh, we're queer people aren't getting visibility on this, you know, in baseball games. Well, it's time to, you know, wear rainbow flags and put, you know, talk about gay baseball players or whatever. But we got to be everywhere. And that's not easy to do. That's not going to be easy. But it's, I think, what is required.
Which shows are you watching these days? What are you enjoying? And are there any themes that you find that relate to your work in highlighting LGBTQ+ representation?
Yeah, I've really been delighted by Our Flag Means Death. I'm so happy with that. Yeah, it's so great. It's such a good show. And it does such a great job of portraying people of different gender orientations and gender identities. It's diverse in a way that I find really lovely. And I am so excited for whatever they're going to do in season two on HBO or whatever HBO has become now. So fingers crossed that's going to stick around long enough to tell that entire story.
Yeah, the love story between Steed and Blackbeard at the and the final hand holding at the end is, oh gosh, it's getting me. It's emotional. It's absolutely one of my favorites. Were there any conversations? I mean, you talked to so many people who were involved in these shows and some of these groundbreaking episodes of television over the years. Were there any conversations that really stand out to you as being illuminating or memorable in the course of doing interviews for the book?
I would say yes, absolutely. Marsha Posner-Williams, as I mentioned, describing how Soap got letters about how Jody helped parents understand their kids. I'd also say that Richard Day, who was a writer and producer, worked on a ton of shows, Ellen, Arrested Development, Drew Carey Show, Gary Shandling. He described the atmosphere in writers' rooms in the 1980s and how hostile they were towards queer people and how it really seemed like a necessity of working in Hollywood to remain in the closet. For him, as a gay man, hearing other writers basically say, well, we could never have a gay person working in a writer's room because then we couldn't tell gay jokes anymore. And, you know, he described this to me and you know, his thought process at the time of, wow, it's more important for you to tell your terrible jokes than, you know, to have a more diverse, you know, you're excluding an entire wing of the population from your profession because you just want to tell your terrible jokes. And he's really come around, Richard has really come around on that. And you know, he had this realization that participating in that culture means participating in your own oppression. And he just couldn't take it anymore. So that was really illuminating as well. And then when I spoke to Norman Lear, I had this question for him that I'd been wondering for years. It involved the character Beverly LaSalle on All in the Family. Variously, she's been described as a drag queen. She herself, that character, describes herself in very different terms. She says drag queen, female impersonator, transvestite. Terminology was very different in the 1970s. And so finally, I was able to ask Norman, how should we talk about this character? How does this character identify? And he kind of laughed at that. And he's like, oh, that was 100%. That was that performer. We found that performer. It was this person named Don McLean, who performed as Laurie Shannon, was his drag persona, in Finocchio's in San Francisco. He said, we found Don McLean, a.k.a. Laurie, and we just brought her onto the show to just do what she does herself. Like, whatever you see with Don and Laurie, that is Beverly LaSalle. So, a drag queen. We finally had an answer to this question that has been plaguing us for decades. Beverly LaSalle, a drag queen, because Norman said she just did exactly what she did in her life as a performer. That's what she played on All in the Family. So, answers.
You use a scene from the pre-production of Soap, the 1977 show that features Billy Crystal as a character, Jody. And Marsha Posner-Williams, at the time, is a secretary on the show and gets a caller asking how to write in an angry letter about this show that had not even been on television yet. And there's something about that conversation that I feel like can tell us something about today's divided way that we speak to each other, that we villainize each other. Tell me how Marsha Posner-Williams responded to this guy who's calling in. He's angry about this show before it's even debuted.
Yeah, she is just the most wonderful person. So Marsha was she'd just been hired as a production secretary, and there was this controversy brewing about Soap because all the news had been reporting about this upcoming show, about how controversial it's going to be. And someone had found out, they'd read this and they wanted to write an angry letter. And she's like, OK, happy to give you the address, but what are you writing about? And the guy says, well, about I'm so angry that the show's going to be on. And she's like, oh, have you seen it? And he says, no, well, it's not on the air yet. And she's like, OK, so what you're writing about is not what you think, but what somebody else told you to think. And they get into this whole conversation. It goes for 15 minutes. Finally, the guy says, all right, you know what? You're right. I'll wait. I'll watch the show. I'll give it a chance. And then I'll write my letter. And I think what you're seeing there is something that it feels very timely today, that there's a sort of, you know, you can maybe call it tribalism or cliquishness, where folks glom onto sometimes a political ideology and they treat it like a team sport. And so I think here's a guy who saw that his team was about to get kind of buffeted by this show that challenged conventional or conservative standards, and was just mad that it seemed to him that his team was losing. And so he wanted to do something about it. And, you know, that's not, it doesn't really reflect reality, but I understand the feeling. And so Marcia, I think very cleverly, was able to just point out, look, you're being manipulated here. Somebody told you to be mad at this, but you don't actually, you're not actually mad about this. And I think that there's a really nice lesson there, you know, that reflects today. A lot of the people who are upset about, for example, trans women in sports, they don't really care about women's sports. They just want to see that their team, the anti-trans team, is winning. You know, and it, often bigotry is not really about the thing that someone is claiming. They've been told that their team has to take a certain position. And so that's just what they've done.
Yeah. And once you actually have that conversation, or once that person is presented with the humanity of another human being, that is diffused in most cases.
I think it does. I'd like to think so, that often just getting to know somebody is very powerful. This is something that we saw on the activist side of things. I had a career in entertainment. I had a career in politics. And this book kind of combines those two things. When I was working in activism as, you know, what people might call Gay Incorporated, I was part of the legal team that brought gay marriage to the Supreme Court back in the mid-2000s. When I was working in gay activism, one of the most important lessons that we learned there was the importance of personal stories and talking to people in one's own life. And when you're doing a PSA, not to have a message like, well, it's unfair, but to make it personal, like, this is unfair for my brother or my sister, whatever. So anyway, yeah, making the personal connection is so important. And I think that's something, that's a lesson that a lot of advocacy groups still struggle with. I think it should be more at the top of their minds when crafting messages and trying to make change.
And you think they can take a lesson from sitcoms?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, to move people, you've got to entertain them, and you've got to tell them a good story. And also you've got to come at them when they're not expecting you to. The worst time to try to change somebody's mind is in the middle of an election. What you got to do is wait until that in-betweeny time when it doesn't seem like there's any battle happening. Show them some personal stories, put good emotional moments in front of people, get them to know folks who are impacted by whatever your issue is, and then it sort of inoculates people when the actual election or lawsuit or whenever the battle, the cultural war is happening. You've gotten them when they're vulnerable, essentially.
Matt Baum charts the history of queer representation in television comedy in his new book, Hi Honey, I'm Homo, Sitcoms, Specials, and the Queering of American Culture. Matt, it's just been such an enjoyable conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it myself.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m., Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.